Hello everyone and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast striving to rebuild our beloved community, creating a more inclusive and shared experience. After last episode where we explored cinema's relation between fiction and reality, it was only right we discussed the form of documentary making. So here to kick us off is Kiriko.
To film or not to film? To make your subject cry, or to offer a shoulder to cry on? How close is close enough, and how close is too close? The duty of a documentary filmmaker is to show how master of reality Werner Herzog likes to call it, the ecstatic truth. A truth that is not necessarily fact-related, but more so a story that is an intensification of the world as we know it. In search of this truth, the documentarian is on an everlasting quest for the secret stories, the hidden pain that has not yet seen the daylight, or the, often troublesome, characters whose voices are yet to be heard. And mankind is vain. If a documentarian asks you to make a film about your life, you will most likely say yes. We like to believe that we are special and that we have a story to tell. The responsibility a documentarian then carries to create a spectacle of one's life is tremendous. How does one exactly create this ecstatic truth? And how does one mold the truth to create the story that we believe is the right one to tell? This is where cinema comes into play. Cinema is a place where realer than real images can be created, where we can film the wishes and nightmares that people have. In a good documentary, human ability and human evil is exposed at its best. Eyesight. Some men just want to watch the world burn, and some men just want to come all over it. Truthful words, which could have been mine, but it's the catchphrase for the new VPRO Dutch documentary series, Zaad van Karbaat, or in English, Seeds of Deceit. Right upon graduating from the Dutch Film Academy, documentary filmmaker Miriam Goodman delved into the genetic heritage of Jan Karbaat, a Dutch fertility doctor who, for years, secretly used his own sperm instead of donors. The aftermath of this crime only became evident after his death. Over 68 people have now officially come forward as a donor child of Jan Karbaat. The film questions not only the mad intentions of the perverted doctor, but follows the lives of his children, raising questions about nature, nurture, and family relations. Goodman successfully recreates the fantasy worlds of the mothers, children, and male donors involved. She uses methods that we might recognize as fiction. The series are a play of reenactments, interviews, found footage, fly on the wall, animation, and visual depictions of sperm everywhere, which some might argue is on the edge of what it means to capture reality. The documentary recently premiered at Sundance and has been largely discussed ever since. We are enlightened to welcome director Miriam Goodman at the table today to discuss her new film, Documentary Ethics, and the Thin Line Between Reality and Fiction.
Hi, thank you so much. What a great introduction.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So your film came out a couple of weeks, months ago now.
Weeks? The last episode has been broadcast this week. So.
And everybody around me has been talking about it.
Well, that's great.
How are you feeling right now?
A bit tired and overwhelmed, but also very happy and grateful. It has been a crazy ride since Sundance. And yeah, it's amazing that it has been sort of what I heard the talk of the day, that many people have been discussing the film. And yeah, that's incredible after working on it for 4 years, that it has actually the impact you wish for. So yeah, I'm really happy.
Super nice. And you, of course, decided some time ago, a couple of years ago, that you wanted to become a filmmaker, I think. But we're curious to know when this seed was first planted. We want to ask you, do you still remember what the first movie experience is that you had when you were a child?
I think it was E.T. I watched that and I was super scared. And E.T. has been following me in my nightmares. not ever since, but for a couple of years back then. And I think that it made a really strong impression on me just to experience. And I was really intrigued back then already that film is such a strong medium and that you can actually have nightmares for weeks just because of watching E.T. And I was raised in a very cultural family, but not specifically a movie loving family, nor was I very interested back then. So it was not like I was raised with Hitchcock or Russian films or classic Italian films like Dolce Vita. I watched The Notebook about 50 times and Sex and the City about 100 times, and that was about it. And my parents even discouraged me to apply to film school because they thought I hadn't watched enough films back then. And I even asked my friend, because you have to fill out your favorite Dutch films, and I hadn't seen any Dutch films. So I even asked my Dutch friend, like, who are, you know, well-known Dutch directors I should fill out.
Damn.
Yeah. So, and I applied for documentary instead of fiction because I thought there were less applicants for documentary.
Wow.
So I have really, and this year my film premiered at Sundance, so that's what can happen.
But this comes close to the true Werner Herzog style of filmmaking, right? That you basically just have to scam your way into making your film because nobody else is going to make it for you. But what was the reason that you then did decide to go to Film Academy, even though that threshold seemed kind of high? Why did you want to go over that threshold?
I was very interested in image, and I was photographing from the age of 10. I made a big trip with my parents and my sister, and I just, photographed every person that I met, and at markets in Mexico, I would just hide around a corner and take secret pictures. And I was just really obsessed with image and photography. And then I made a photo series when I was 17 of my peers and classmates who lost a parent or two parents. And I was completely shocked and overwhelmed by the fact that so many friends lost a parent, and I just didn't know what to do with it. And then I decided to make a photo series, and it was in the garage of my parents because there was where they parked the bicycles, because there was the most beautiful daylight. And through that, I discovered that, and my camera was really a medium to connect and to have conversations with them, dare to ask questions that I didn't dare without a camera. And we had really interesting conversations, but nobody could witness them except for me. And that made me realize that I really wanted to tell stories and combine image and story together.
With a camera that can press record.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to go to film school. So it was not like, I wasn't really raised with, you know, many movies, but I was very interested in storytelling and people, and
So was there a moment after Sex and the City and The Notebook that you watched a film that made you go, oh damn, this is what I can do with my medium now?
I think it was actually at film school that I watched The Act of Killing by Joshua Oppenheimer, and that film really had a huge impact on me and completely blew me away, because did not only transform me as a viewer, but it also transformed the characters in the documentary. It's about Indonesia, where many communists were killed and the killers still just walk around freely. And the director asked them to re-experience their killings and relive them and re-act them. And therefore, the main characters sort of went through an emotional arc of, oh my God, this is what we've been doing. And that film really blew me away.
Which in some way can also be directly linked to the film that you just made, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So was that also an inspiration for you to make The Seeds of the Seed?
It was, yeah. That film, together with casting JonBenet, was really the origin of the form. So in The Act of Killing, Oppenheimer asks the killers to reenact their murders, their killings. And I asked my subjects, who are not killers, but victims of the inseminations and often sexual assault, to relive those experiences, which was really challenging, of course. And I asked a lot from them, and I find them extremely courageous for doing so. But I really wanted to confront and also help them in their process of trauma. And some mothers even like really thanked me for this experience. And I really believe that documentary, just like fiction, should really captivate the viewer. And I wanted the viewers to be present at that moment. And I think that documentary should be more than talking heads and running behind your characters. So therefore I did that. But The Act of Killing was an incredible inspiration for this series.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And I was also quite captivated by that scene, because it also in some ways seems quite risky to do that with those women. And I'm glad you're saying that they thanked you afterwards, but it could have also maybe gone wrong. Or I think it's also a method of therapy to to go through an experience again in the same setting. So yeah, it's, I'm sure you've guided them in a very good way.
Yeah, and I was very invested in their lives. We talked about it frequently before we shot that scene. So it's not like I opened a door and boom, there was the insemination room. And it was, yeah, it was really daring. And also for me as a director and as a person, that those ethical questions, can I ask that from someone to relive that that traumatic experience, yes or no? And it also caused a lot of discussion afterwards. A lot of filmmakers from, in their 60s specifically, have their moral questions around scenes like these. But to me, these were not the most difficult ethical questions, actually.
Yeah, well, according to you, what was the biggest challenge that you took in making this film? Or maybe the scene in which you carried the largest moral responsibility as a filmmaker?
A lot comes to mind, I think. Yeah, so older documentary filmmakers seem quite impressed with these sexual assault scene and even distressed by the reenactment scenes in the series. But yeah, I personally didn't struggle with it too much because I was really close and still am with all the characters involved. And we discussed it and one mother didn't want to relive that experience. And then, of course, we didn't. So I think it's also very much about just having a moral compass and being sensitive for what the characters in the film want and what they don't want, and give them enough time to think about it. But I think I was most concerned with the sexual assault allegations and how I had to bring this news in a truthful and not sensationalist way, and to the world, and to specifically to all the children involved, because there are 15 children in the series, but there are also 55 half-brothers and sisters who are not participating in the series. And who also, in the last couple of weeks, got to know this awful fact about their biological father. So I think, to me, the biggest burden is not the scenes, but what they do to the people involved and what it means to their lives. That's what really, kept me up at night the last weeks.
I have a question about that, because I remember seeing your film as your graduation film at the Film Academy. And then, of course, there's a limit at how long it can be. It's only like 25 minutes or something, right?
Yeah.
What did the, now it's a 3-part miniseries, which are, I think, maybe 50 minutes per episode or something?
Yeah, it's 45, yeah.
45. So you have so much more time and space to address all of these things. Did that make that project easier or more difficult? Because that very condensed version on the Film Academy, there's some things that you already can get into, but maybe the more specific things that you're now talking about, what did that allow you to have all that time now?
Yeah, I really like that question, because I think I could do more justice to the story, and that's why I wanted to make a longer version. So that, in that sense, it made it easier. But what it made it more difficult was that the condensed version was about two mothers and their two children. Yeah. And it was very intimate and very sort of on an individual level. And it was important for those four characters to recognize themselves. And it didn't really matter what the others thought.
Yeah.
And now I feel much more that I have to do justice to everybody involved. And the group is so big that that's really difficult, because everybody has their own individual story and upbringing and parents. And yeah, that's really the most challenging about this project so far.
I think that's very funny, because it's also kind of reflective of Jan Karbaat, that your film has to become sprawling in a sense, because his enterprise was also very much sprawling and messy and chaotic. So your film somehow needs to deal with his unstructural mess he made.
Yeah.
Does it sometimes feel like you are cleaning up his mess in a sense?
It does, yeah. And that's an interesting observation, because some people do shoot the messenger, and I'm the messenger.
Yeah.
I'm bringing this news to the light, and they, of course, many children are upset. And I'm the person who did that research and who brought it into the world. And yeah, you can shoot me, you can't shoot him, because he's dead already.
And I was wondering this because, the Film Academy version of The Seed of the Seed is, also through its intimate nature, very much a product of maybe the Netherlands in a sense as well. It's a postage stamp version of this bigger image, right? And here you expand in your series, you expand on the subject so much that I am wondering, in what way did maybe an international perspective also come with that? Mm. Because I can see that some of the people in the film have this kind of strange Dutch sober, we don't really talk about this approach to, for instance, sexual assault and rape. And in light of, for instance, the Me Too activism from 2016, which was mostly started in the US, I'm wondering if that international scope or this bigger scale maybe change a bit of your approach around surrounding this as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it didn't really change the process. But when I was editing, I realized, as for example, this scene, which you edit in a day, you know, you edit that scene in a day, and then you think, oh, that's a really powerful, intriguing scene. But then when you get closer to the final edit, you realize how some scenes will be framed. And you also, we organized a viewing with all the characters involved, and then it's still very intimate. And then when the series were released, for example, the news really picked up this sexual assault fact and they've reposted it. And I knew that it was going to be Me Too, but I didn't know that it was going to be sort of the only sensational fact that was, you know,
yeah,
put in every news outlet.
Because that's a reductive take on the whole series, because it's not the only sensational.
No, not at all.
Everything about it is in a strange way sensational.
Yeah. But for example, I did... In my research, I found out that there were several doctors around the world who also used their own sperm. And I interviewed some of those children and they talked about it in such an American way. And you also see that in the last episode. And that's really funny for us Dutch people to see how they deal with. For example, all of them are talking about consent. And that word is, you know, not really touched upon as often here, because that's not how we deal with those. And for example, the mothers didn't see it as Me Too.
Yeah.
But because we live in this time and because I compiled their different stories, it is Me Too. And it becomes framed that way because of the zeitgeist and, you know, the world we live in right now.
No, that's a really good answer, because it's reflective of how vocabulary changed and how that suddenly gets picked up a little bit by the Netherlands, maybe also via a project like this.
And in a way, you're also an historian who's putting a certain setting of what something that happened many years ago in a modern day situation. So in that way, I think it's more than correct that it gets a Me Too label in that way.
Yeah.
I was interested in what you were saying earlier about how you, as a messenger of the story, also carry responsibility of sort of keeping this family together, or at least being the link between all these children. And I'm sure you've probably become friends with a number of them. As a documentarian, just in general, not necessarily for this project, how is it that you deal or communicate differently with people that are your friends or people that you want to make movies about?
Yeah, I love that question. I don't give my personal opinion when I'm researching or interviewing my subject, so people know me less. My subjects don't know me, I'd say. They know a version of me. They know the version who likes to listen. Because many characters, for example, read interviews with me now and said, oh, whoa, you have such an interesting family history. Or I never talk about my personal views on things. My tactic is that whenever I research people or listen to people, I just really try to listen and understand their point of view and their feelings and their emotions. And it's really not interesting what I think or the fact that I just heard an opposite view on the same subject matter. Because I never talk about, you know, where I live, where I come from, or, you know, my family history. It all doesn't matter, because they also don't have in Dutch, you would say, ze hebben daar geen boodschap aan. Like, it's not interesting because I'm making a film about their lives. What does it matter? And it's about gaining trust and investing time. And it's about just your moral compass. And I did my very best to make the most Integer series I could. And that was my main responsibility. And it's not about building a friendship in an equal way. And it's nice because I became really acquainted with, and, you know, we watched the series together and I feel really close to them. But you should, as a documentary filmmaker, I think you should always have the overview. And because also these perspectives were so different from one another, people look at this story in such opposite ways that you shouldn't be opinionated. Also, you shouldn't prefer, you know, one subject to another subject. You should just have the overview and do every single story justice.
I think that's also one of the most touching aspects of the film, is that it kind of shows that from these crimes, there can also be, like, people find ways to make something very beautiful with it, you know, despite or maybe because of the fact they find ways to bond. But then you also show, and I think that's the maybe genius part, that bonding, that beautiful group of people that are together and form their own improvised family, that even there's also a form of social exclusion, that, you know, the one good thing also though always has a different side. And I'm wondering what it was like finding that balance, right? Because you want to do what you say in justice to everybody in a sense, and it is very much about justice because a crime is at the center of the story as well.
Yeah, what I find very interesting is that the crime is also the reason they're alive.
Yeah,
so that in itself is such a, you know, double-edged sword. That's what keeps it an interesting story after 4 years, that it's not just crime, because if he hadn't committed that crime, those children wouldn't have been there.
Well, and then, no, that's great. And then how do you, you know, balance the good side of that and then also acknowledge in the present that there's a downside even from that, right? It's like, it's not only, hey, we're a merry, happy, improvised family, but there's also people that know that there's a merry, happy family, but they can't access that because they are feeling the more, let's say, dark side of this crime.
Yeah, that's actually the biggest reason that I made a series and not just a long documentary. Those perspectives of the parents and the children and the donors are so different. And then indeed within these groups, the children also look very differently at what their biological father did and what they think of each other. But that's why I made a mini series to really show those different perspectives.
Yeah, it's also funny how in some way or another, because you are the person who has the overview of what makes all these characters so different and how they are in some way or another also alike, you have created also their identity, because you in the end are the person who's also naming the things that they have in common or naming the things that makes them different from one another. So I think probably for these children, I mean, they're not children, they're grown-ups, but for the children as well, you have quite explicitly exposed them to what their similarities are. Do you feel that you are in some way or another also the author of what these family characteristics are?
The family characteristics, I explicitly asked them in my research phase, what do you think are the family characteristics? So I really copied those answers from the children because I found it important that I wasn't making them up and that they were really true and genuine. But of course I'm the author of this story, so, you know, you would have made a completely different film of the same story, and that's where the responsibility comes into play. It was a huge responsibility because it's not just one singular story, there are hundreds of people involved in this story. And I'm also, you know, I'm getting several emails a day from people who went to the clinic and had similar experiences or not. And yeah, that's what's really the most difficult.
And is there also characteristics of the family members that came up as you were making the film, or things that people started telling you or that people started seeing because you were exposing them to one another? Or
I did really extensive research, so I knew upfront, for example, these characteristics, what I wanted to show, but it was a story that kept developing. So there were, for example, in episode 2, the fact that two half-brothers of Karbat, their half-brothers they grew up with, were also half-brothers. You have to watch the series to understand this.
You made a nice infographic which shows you exactly how.
Yeah. But for example, that big donor groups have connections underneath, that happened while filming. Or for example, as a filmmaker, I hope that the first Karbat child from abroad would be found. And then that happened, so we could film that. So it was really a story that kept on developing and growing. And also, when I started, there were 19 children, and now there are 68 children. So often I would go to bed, and then the next day I would wake up, and there were new children added to, you know, the group.
The roster of characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And all these people have the same hand. I love that. Such a hard thing. Especially the story of the one woman who tells that she went to his house, and that the first thing that he just said was, "Show me your hands."
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a Karbat.
Yeah.
Which for me was such an odd thing, because it becomes a bit religious in a horrible way there,
yeah.
Where it's like, "Show me your totem." Yes, you are a Christian. You are part of the cult now.
Mm.
And also there is this very sort of interesting, maybe it's part of the man himself. There's such a duality about him in the sense that he did very good things for insemination,
yeah.
And lesbian couples that want, or single moms want,
yeah.
to have a child. And then he did do it himself, to phrase it very
awkwardly.
But there is a very sort of almost religious feeling among the children, where there is almost a purpose in their life to find each other, and a very nice sort of communal experience from this tragedy.
I wouldn't say that it's their purpose to find each other, but I think that many of them come from families where they couldn't recognize themselves in their legal fathers, and they couldn't recognize themselves in their siblings, because they were often half siblings, although Karbat promised the parents that they would have children from the same donor. He didn't. So I think that many children recognize themselves in one another and finally have this feeling of recognition and belonging, which they never had in their own families. But it's also, the number is, you know, they're now 68 children. It almost makes them numb for meeting new siblings. And yeah, many of them just pick their favorite 3 to 5 half brothers and sisters, because you also don't have 68 best friends. You know, it's just too many people.
It's interesting that the belonging means a lot, but it starts meaning less and less.
Yeah. To go on that thing a little bit, I was thinking that some of the project that they undertake is kind of, and now I have to go back to Oppenheimer, right? Kind of an act of healing rather than the other way around. It's kind of this restorative action to, you know, fill up a void that has definitely been there, which it does bring me to a question. You were saying that, you know, just, yeah, Oppenheimer and the act of killing has been a very inspirational film for a project like this. And we've discussed what that means when you place people in these recreated scenarios to relive certain aspects of their past lives. However, the film is much more than only that. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because what Kiriko also pointed at, you know, there's a combination of these reenactments, but also you've done extensive archival research. So much archival footage is there. You have these animations. It's a lot of things, you know, just like we talked about the sprawling nature of the story. Can you talk about that as a filmmaker, that challenge of combining all of those things? Because it's not a one-note film. Mm-hmm. It has so many, you know, multitudes.
I'd love to. When I made my graduation film, it was only talking heads.
Yeah.
And a few reenactment scenes. And I immediately realized, okay, I can't keep up with only these form elements for a series or for a long format documentary. And then I thought, okay, well, I'll be just filming documentary scenes where you actually, you know, I was present at one of those meetings where half brothers and sisters meet each other for the first time, which was sort of magical. And I thought, okay, I really want to film that. And that should just be with a cinematographer who has a camera on his shoulder. And it was funny, because I remember thinking, okay, can I combine all these form elements? And I was like, well, yeah, I'll just give it a shot. And we filmed at the court case, and then I had my first sort of documentary scene, and I just edited that myself with my graduation film to see how that worked. And I thought, yeah, why not? And then my editor, Sander Nijsto, was genius.
He's really good.
He's incredible. And because the animation part, we didn't budget and we didn't write that in our film plan. But some things, for example, that the half-brother of the half-brother is the half-brother of the half-brother, was just so so difficult to explain to people that we thought, okay, we should really use animation. And luckily, he was willing to do that in his night. Yeah. So I really like to watch films, you know, where there's really been thought about the form and the aesthetics. And I think that we all watch, you know, Netflix and HBO and many fiction films, but also documentaries where there has been thought about that. So I made the film that I wanted to watch if somebody would have made a film about this subject.
Mm.
I think that's what I did. I watched Casting JonBenet just before I made my graduation film. And that's a film by Kitty Green. Yeah. And it's a hybrid documentary film about the death of JonBenet and the large impact it left behind. And the film is the casting process for the reenactments in the documentary. But because all these actors actually live in the place where that murder took place, they also have their own personal views on this murder case. Okay, it's really...
No, it's a really great film.
Yeah. And I watched that and I thought, Jesus, this is so multi-layered. That was an incredible inspiration for me.
I can also imagine that her film after that, The Assistant, might have been of some value for you as well, because it's also about sexual harassment and, you know, all the, like, the crimes. And instead of centered around this towering figure, this Weinstein-esque monster, which is usually what, you know, the media, as you have seen with your film as well, would love to focus on, it also shows what happens at the margins of that story, which is actually the core of the story, because those are the victims, either physically or mentally. Was that also maybe in some ways an intention?
I'm very sorry, but I haven't seen it yet, but I would love to watch
it. But then it's an interesting overlap,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. But she was an incredible inspiration for me.
Yeah. It's also nice in how the characters from Casting JonBenet, it plays with the same element that you play with in your film, how people living their lives are a character of a larger story that maybe they're not even conscious of which you are the author.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful position that you possess.
Oh,
also.
Yeah.
In a good way, because, I mean, you told the story in the right way. It's very exciting. I was going to the questions of the audience. Yep. I have one question from Marco, who asked how you get such personal information with such a sensitive subject.
Yeah, many people have been asking this question. I think it's really a matter of investment in spending time with these people, in listening to their stories, in gaining trust. And I always ask people for their motivation, because I find it really important that that's the right motivation, or a motivation I can relate to, and not like becoming famous. And many children also told me, like, we just don't want this to happen again. So it's also a very important subject to shed light on. And also it helped many people in rebuilding their relationships. So two mothers and their children really sort of reconnected through conversations they were having because of this series. And while I was there, they're speaking to me, of course, but I also had a really engaged crew, and many of my crew members from my graduation film also did the series with me, and they were also just so engaged and so involved and so warm to these people. So I think that really, really helped.
Where does your duty then lie between doing your characters justice and doing the documentary justice?
Yeah, that was a very difficult and interesting transformation, because I did my graduation film, then I researched for 1.5 years, and then we started filming. I think that in the first place, as a documentary filmmaker, you should have a moral compass, you should be sensitive, and you should be a really good listener. And we organized a viewing at the end of the editing process, but before Picture Lock, and where I invited everybody in the series, and they all watched it together, which was a really emotional and beautiful experience. All of them said, you did the story justice, this is my story, thank you. That was the most exciting day for me. It was like more exciting than Sundance, because that's my responsibility. And some people disagreed with other people in the series, but that you cannot...
That's interpersonal.
Exactly.
That's not between you
exactly.
and them.
But know? When all those individuals feel happy with how I portrayed them, then that's what you can do. That's
beautiful.
Yeah.
And
I have one more question from a listener from Instagram who's called Maup with a P, who asks what kind of themes you think are interesting and important to talk about in documentary or in film in general.
I can't answer that in general, but I spoke to John Apple the other day, who's a very interesting documentary filmmaker. And I asked him, because now I'm, you know, thinking about the next subject and I feel like I'm a student again. I feel like I have to start all over. And I said, John, when do you know when it's the right subject? Because I was a little naive back then when I, you know, read this article about an insemination doctor who used his own sperm. I was like, wow, that's interesting. But also, okay, I just need to find a graduation film subject right now. And that sounds pretty interesting. I had no idea that it would take me 4 years. And then it became a success. And now I'm less naive than 4 years ago. And I asked John, like, okay, when do you know it's right? You know, because I read so many articles which I find interesting. When do you know it's right? And he said, you will discover that you have a couple of themes in your life, which you'll recognize in other people, their stories, but which are about you. So he said, for me, it's loneliness and death. And I don't know, I mean, I'm 26 and this is my first film, but I do know that I find identity always very interesting, injustice. So I'm trying to recognize that when I, in finding my next subject.
John Apple sounds like somebody who should read your tarot card.
Yeah, I think he would be great at that.
And maybe just to end it, because I think I really like your observation that being a documentarian is kind of like being a student perpetually of life, right? Isn't that what it is about? That you just have to observe and learn things and then...
Know nothing again.
Make a project that you get very stressed about and graduate with it all the time again.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful summary of my profession.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Miriam.
Thank you.
We're very excited, I think, to follow your journey.
Thanks so much.
And then I think we have a suggestion for the film club for next week.
Yes. So our film choice for next episode is going to be The Congress by Ari Folman, starring Robin Wright, as we are going to unpack the Academy of the Oscars, exploring issues of inclusivity and the purpose of the awards. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so send us an email at celebratingcinema@lab111.nl or leave a message on our website. Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was really great.
Yeah, thanks so much.